tonight's talk, and as I mentioned to a couple of you at the break, if what I say is not your experience, or you've had a different experience, raise your hand and please tell us, you know, how this applies, or maybe it doesn't apply. When Rich and I were learning to be mentors and going on for mentor training, we were taught to speak from our own experience, because that's really all we can speak from. And then hopefully we find something in the Buddha's teachings that validates our experience. And so that's what I am going to talk about tonight, is one of my, if not my favorite, sutta in Pali, sutra in Sanskrit, is Majjhima Nikaya 19. Majjhima Nikaya are the middle length discourses. And it's entitled The Two Types of Thinking. And if any of you spend any time observing your mind, and if you're a meditator, you spend time observing your mind, you will see kind of that you're insane. And all these thoughts and weirdness, and if you were to say out loud everything that was going on, yeah, you'd be off someplace. And so the Buddha also experienced this, these random thoughts, some of which were very helpful in guiding, and some which perhaps shows our worst nature. He dealt with this. And the Majjhima Nikaya 19 talks about it, the two types of thinking. And so before I begin, I want to find out, has anybody ever worked with actually looking at the kind of thoughts you have, trying to classify them as to this is helpful, this is definitely not helpful? Yes. Anybody want to say anything, what they found out when they did that? All right, so Renee, do you have anything to say about that?
So it really depends on my state of mind and my state of my body.
Yeah.
So if I'm tired and a lot of weird things have been happening, then things I can ruminate pretty easily. And then in the morning when I'm fresh and I've just woken up and I get a night's sleep, and I could be way more positive and start off with.
Right.
So it really, really depends.
And, yeah.
You know, it seems to be dependent on what's happening just before. You know.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point, because the third satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness, the third is, what is your mental state? Because that's going to color everything as well. So it's not just these crazy thoughts that are going on, it's also what kind of state of mind are you in that is interpreting these crazy thoughts. So I'm going to read not the whole sutta, it's a little bit long, but I'm going to read, I think, the relevant parts. And the Blessed One said, "Monks, before my self-awakening, when I was still just an unawakened bodhisattva, the thought occurred to me, why don't I keep dividing my thinking into two sorts? So I made thinking imbued with sensuality, thinking imbued with ill will, and thinking imbued with harmfulness one sort, and thinking imbued with renunciation, thinking imbued with non-ill will, and thinking imbued with harmlessness another sort. And as I remained thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, thinking imbued with sensuality arose in me. I discerned that thinking imbued with sensuality has arisen in me, and that leads to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both of us. It obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to unbinding." And then he goes into the other two that lead to unskillfulness. And then he says, "As I notice that it leads to my own affliction, it subsided. So actually being mindful, noticing that this causes suffering, it subsided. As I notice that it leads to the affliction of others, to the affliction of both, it obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to unbinding, it subsided. Whenever thinking imbued with sensuality had arisen, I simply abandoned it, dispelled it, wiped it out of existence. Easier said than done, huh? Which is what we're going to be going into a little bit. And then later on, he kind of summarizes it as he goes into thinking imbued with sensuality, ill will, and harmfulness. Whatever a monk keeps pursuing with his thinking and pondering, that becomes the inclination of his awareness. If a monk keeps pursuing thinking imbued with sensuality, abandoning thinking imbued with renunciation, his mind is bent by that thinking imbued with sensuality. If a monk keeps pursuing thinking imbued with ill will, abandoning thinking imbued with non-ill will, that's the way his mind will go. If a monk keeps pursuing thinking imbued with harmfulness, abandoning thinking imbued with harmlessness, his mind is bent by that thinking imbued with harmfulness. So he actually just made these two columns, at least that's the way I visualize it. And as thinking comes up, click, you know, there's something I'm wishing really ill will toward somebody. Click, I'm feeling really kind toward this person, actually noticing it and actually noticing it in the body. And then he says there are antidotes for these three. Now remember, the three are the afflictive states are ill will, sensuality, and harmfulness, wishing harm on another, which I think is a little like taking ill will on steroids, really wishing harm to somebody, not just, you know, I don't like that person. So as I was studying this, I kind of recognized something and I thought, this is interesting. And I looked it up and yep, this is right intention, right thought, which is the second of the Noble Eightfold Path. And the reason now I'm getting kind of deep and some of this is not going to sound interesting, but he had said that he discovered this before he was awakened. And the teachings are the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path appeared on the night of his awakening. Apparently he did a lot of work ahead of time, if this is any indication. Because he said, before I was awakened, I noticed these two types of thoughts. And that should give all of us hope. If the Buddha was doing this work before he was awakened, and look how far he got, you know, there's hope for all of us. So investigating our minds alleviates suffering. And that's what I'm going to be talked to. I became interested in this sutta, and I've given this talk before. 4 or 5 years ago, I started doing solo month-long retreats. And I decided on the very first one not to do a traditional retreat, but to do whatever I wanted. So anything went, but I was going to follow Majjhima Nikaya 19. I was going to look at everything I did and every thought I had. Is this going to lead to contentment and happiness and ease, or is it not? And what I found was I couldn't do a whole lot. And it actually made sense when you go on retreat when there is so much renunciation. So I thought, you know what, I'll listen to NPR on my retreat. Well, the agitation that came up and the political stuff that was happening at the time, everything, it just, no, this is not creating a mind of ease. This is creating ill will. It's creating a lot of things I don't want to have happen. And the same with, I will watch movies on my retreat. Well, there weren't too many that I could watch, so I had to give that up. What I found I could do was I could practice my guitar. I could read suttas and books on the Dharma. I could walk and I could sit. That's what I could do. That didn't cause a lot of agitation. I could eat, but I had to be careful about what I was eating because sensual desire comes up. I'll eat whatever I want. And you know what happens when you eat whatever you want. It's going to cause all kinds of problems. So I started using that, and I'm going to have an assignment for all of you at the end of this where you can work with this as well. And I think it's a really interesting exercise. And what you find out when you start working with this and actually noticing the various thoughts that are going on, and as the Buddha said, not allowing the thoughts that cause suffering, unease, unhappiness, ill will, desire constantly happening, a contentment and ease starts taking place. Now, I'm not saying exuberant happiness. You look at the Buddha sitting there, he's got a look of real ease, like anything could happen and it's okay. That's where we want to be in a state of equanimity, not a state of just giddy happiness, because that doesn't last. It's inevitable that's going to stop, but equanimity can. That can be developed. So let's look a little bit more deeply at the three conditions for unskillful and skillful thought. So the very first one is desire. Desire. The Buddha calls it sensual desire. Desire can never be satisfied. Ever notice that? It can never, ever be satisfied. Now, I experimented with this on my retreat. And I experiment with this almost every weekend too, because on weekends, I allow myself the luxury of eating whatever I want. On one day, I can eat whatever I want. So I'm a vegan, so I do eat Impossible Burgers on Saturday nights. They're great. They're so good. And you can make baked French fries and coconut ice cream and all these great things. And as you start eating them, what I notice in my mind is, how do I keep this going? I haven't even finished anything and I'm worried about it's going to end. Notice this. This is a wonderful, wonderful experiment to just see how the mind works. And then you see, and so I fortunately have quit doing this, but some of you might, if you eat fast enough, maybe you can get more in and get that sensual desire going for a longer period of time. I found that doesn't work, so I've quit doing that. I've gotten a little bit wise about that. So what the Buddha said is true. If we think that this sensual desire is going to solve anything and is going to keep us happy, it's not. It's going to end. So give it up. So what's the antidote for sensual desire of this kind, no matter what it is? Cars, vacations, food, you know, sex, anything. What's the Buddha's antidote for this? Restraint, renunciation. Ooh, that word renunciation. But renunciation doesn't mean you stop. It means you actually understand what's going on. And you can actually be in the moment and actually appreciate you know, whatever you're enjoying, not what am I going to do when it ends? How am I going to keep this going? But actually be present for what's taking place. That's a completely different mindset than I've got to keep it going. To keep it going, that's addiction. You know, that's sensual desire going to the far end. So the second one is, I also, as I was thinking about this, you know, in our society now, for so many of us, we can purchase anything we want. We can do what we want. We're so fortunate. And yet depression and suicide are at an all-time high. So sensual desire is not helping things. It's making things worse. As the Buddha said, you know, thousands of years ago, ill will. So the intention of goodwill opposes the intention of ill will. The Buddha mentions that traditionally there were two ways of dealing with ill will. Anybody know what they are? Not saying these are the right ways, but it's typical of what had been done. First one is yield to it. Anybody remember pillow throwing therapy when you're angry? I remember this from many years ago, and you're supposed to take a pillow and just swat whoever and hit them, and your anger gets out. And the Buddha said, it doesn't. It might for a short period of time, but all you're learning is anger. You're getting better at it. You're not stopping it, and you're still suffering from it. And the other one is repressing it. That's no good either. Repressing it will just mean it's probably going to come out in the body, in pains and migraines and mental attitudes, all sorts of things. So what's the antidote for ill will?
Metta.
That's right, metta. And metta is boundless friendliness. Not an easy practice, but I know many of you here use it, and it has changed everything. If you can, as you are feeling ill will coming up, and the way I use it is, I've been in that place, I've been that person, I've done that thing, and I am grateful somebody forgave me and wished me the best. Can I do that for this person? That's my own practice, and maybe you have found something that works for you, but you have to turn that around and not let ill will just run rampant. It will cause so much suffering. And then harmfulness, like I said, it's ill will on steroids. And the antidote for wishing harm on somebody is what? Long-time practitioners here? Karuna, compassion. Remember in the Brahma Viharas, the four immeasurables, the far enemy of compassion is cruelty. So here he's saying in the dividing thinking up, you've got to bring in compassion when you are feeling that you wish to harm somebody. However you do that, you know, the Brahma Viharas have a series of, which I'm not going to be talking about tonight, but it's certainly something we have discussed, a series of exercises to start changing the mind. So harmfulness is not your default place. Instead, it's karuna, compassion for that person. This is from Bhikkhu Bodhi. Just one quick statement. Real security always lies on the side of truth, not on the side of comfort. And I think that's a really good thing to remember. Comfort is kind of easy to come by, and it comes and goes and comes and goes. Truth is a lot more difficult, but it stays. And it guides you onto what you need to be doing. So what about pain and loss? Okay, so we're back to two types of thinking, the kind of thinking that causes ease and contentment, and then the thinking that doesn't. And the Buddha named three kinds. But what about pain and loss? Doesn't that cause kind of harm to yourself and unhappiness? Should we be thinking about those things? What do you think? I'm seeing a lot of question marks. Not sure. Yeah. That's exactly right, which is what we will be. Thank you very much, Margaret. That's exactly right. In fact, when I asked if this is something that you avoid, because in the two types of thinking, there's unease that happens with pain and loss. Margaret said, no, because there's the five recollections. This will be the subject of the day-long retreat, which is actually looking deeply into pain, loss, death, separation from those you love, separation from everything you love, which is inevitable. The Dharma is the way life is. And if we keep trying to escape it, that's not truth. As Bhikkhu Bodhi said, real security always lies on the side of truth, not on the side of comfort. And those of you who have been practicing with the five recollections, and some of you have come to my Year to Live group as well, you know the comfort that comes from accepting the way life is and not hiding from it. The Dharma is, you know, I think you have to be a grown-up to practice Dharma. You can't be a little kid. You have to accept that life happens. And sometimes it is horribly painful, but that's the way it is. Now what do you do? But the Dharma is, now what do you do with what is taking place? Yeah.
So that would be understanding the First Noble Truth.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. The Four Noble Truths go right into that. There is suffering in life. There's a reason for suffering. There's a way out of suffering, and the way out of suffering is the Noble Eightfold Path. So, anybody listen to the podcast Invisibilia? I love that podcast. I think it is really, really well done. It's, I think their byline is investigating things that are not seen, feelings and thoughts and the underlying things in our minds. And they had a podcast on, it's called Amplified Pain Syndrome. I'm glad Matt's here because he could probably add to this because I'm probably going to get this wrong. But it was really interesting. Matt, did you happen to hear this? It was about a young girl, 15 years old, and she had been a dancer, a really talented dancer, and all of a sudden she started having trouble with her hips. And then it spread to her legs, and then to her arms, and then to her hands. And she was in so much pain that she said, even the wind on my skin was painful and caused me to cry. I can't even imagine this kind of pain, but that's what she was in. And she went to doctor after doctor after doctor, and they said, we cannot find an organic reason for this pain. It's in your head, go see a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist didn't help. And she went to, you know, three or four different scenarios of people who said they could deal with this, and finally ended up with this one guy who said, I think the problem is that you have developed such an intolerance to pain that the synapses in the brain, every time pain comes up, create more and more pain because you are not dealing with pain. It's like the story of the second dart. You know, the first dart is pain happens. Second dart is us ruminating about how much pain I'm in. And so she joined, before she saw this particular therapist, she joined a group of young girls who all had the same syndrome. Apparently, there's something like 15,000 girls in this country who has this, teenage girls. And they have support groups. They didn't say anything, but I'm wondering how good the support groups are, because they would talk about their pain, but not the underlying reason for any of this pain, just how bad it was and how it's escalating. So his theory was, and for her it worked, was to actually start allowing pain to happen and work through it, literally be with it. I'm going to quote what he said. His name is Wallace, the therapist is Wallace. Wallace believes that when you're unable to name and think about your emotions and don't have the tools to diffuse them, whatever stress you experience is directed at and absorbed by the body. That's an important part of the problem with these girls. They're not in touch with their feelings. They just plaster on what the program calls I'm fine face. So Wallace says, one way to understand what's happening to them is that their nervous systems go haywire because they don't have the sophisticated emotional skills they need to manage a stressful world. And what they're finding is that kids this age, this is happening more and more and more. And he said, so in treatment, when the kids are going through their exercises before and after their activities, trainers will ask them to describe in one word how they're feeling, kind of like what Renee was saying, you know, what is going on right now, and actually deal with what's taking place right now and not the anticipatory pain that was happening because they were dealing with the second dart, not the original cause. So this girl at the end of the podcast was back to dancing again. She had to go through a lot of, the whole therapy was be with this pain, don't make up stories about it, don't look for it to go somewhere else, be with it, work through it, and let's talk about it. And it worked for her. Like he said, today our kids are going so much faster. They are expected to do so much more. There's so much stress that it's not uncommon for this to be taking place and more, especially young people and teenagers. So back to this, evaluating our thoughts on the cushion. That's actually an easy place to look at what's going on. You ever notice that? You can actually be quiet and see what's going on and see what's coming up. I had an experience just Tuesday night. I was in prison and sitting with the men, and this was weird. I had had a somewhat upsetting email earlier in the day. And I thought it was out of my mind. And as I was sitting there, all of a sudden a pain came up in my head, and then the thought came about the email. The body first and the thought later, which was, wow, just look what's happening, you know, in our bodies when we think we've got everything taken care of. So on the cushion, you can start seeing these things much easier. It's not as easy to practice out in daily life. What are the thoughts that are skillful, and what are the thoughts that are not skillful? And here, the caveat is going to be, if you haven't been practicing with virtuous conduct, it's going to be very difficult working with this both off and on the cushion. Virtuous conduct. The Buddha said this is the very first practice, the precepts, course on climate change and the precepts. Why is that? Well, I've got two acquaintances who are having all kinds of difficulties with each other. And they said they've sat and thought about it, and they know that they're right and the other person is wrong, and they're writing horrible emails and Facebook postings and all of this stuff. Is this virtuous conduct? Is this really getting into their thinking process? No, it's going into a scenario that they want to believe. It's not truth. It might give them a modicum of comfort for the moment, thinking they're right, but it's not solving anything. So virtuous conduct really has to come in before we can even practice any of this. Otherwise, our thinking starts out distorted. And we're going to try to solve something with very distorted thinking. There's an article I picked out, the latest in military strategy mindfulness. And I'm sure many of you have seen this or heard about this, but NATO plans on using mindfulness, and they're holding a two-day symposium in Berlin to discuss the evidence of mindfulness in warfare. This is what got me started thinking, where is virtuous conduct? And sometimes I have problems with secular mindfulness for exactly this reason. This winter, Army infantry soldiers at Schofield Barracks in Hawaii began using mindfulness to improve shooting skills. When Rich and I were going through our mentoring program, I remember this coming up and talking about you can be very mindful and you can be a mindful assassin. So there's a reason for the Noble Eightfold Path, and there's a reason for including virtuous conduct in all of our mindfulness, in our sitting practice, in discerning the types of thinking are helpful and not helpful. How can you do that if you are not practicing virtuous conduct? You can't. You'll be saying, how can I kill somebody skillfully? Which is what this is all about. So off the cushion is more difficult, but here's where I'm going to suggest an experiment for you. And I want you to take a day of reflection, but while living your normal life, not a retreat day, but just an average day. And the first thing when you get up in the morning, notice what is going on. What is skillful and what isn't skillful? Eating your breakfast, having a cup of coffee, turn on the radio or the TV. Is there agitation in the mind when you do that? Then don't do it. Just don't do it. Does playing music or practicing a musical instrument cause you ease? Do it. Then do it. Getting on the internet. How does that work for you? There's another interesting, well, I'll go into that in a minute. Journal what you find out. Actually take time. Notice when you're doing nothing. Notice when you're just sitting, observing. You know, maybe on a park bench, and you're just sitting, observing. Notice what the mind is doing. The mind is probably at ease. Until some of those thoughts come up, let them go and come back to just observing and having a mind at ease. We don't do that. We hardly ever do that because we're so busy. We have to do something else. We have to get someplace. We have to see somebody. We don't take the time. I think I told you all, a couple of years ago, I got onto this thing about reading the classics, books, the 100 greatest books of all time. I get on these kicks. And so I've read all of Dostoevsky, Tolstoy. I haven't read all of Tolstoy. But one thing I found out, Gogol, I got into Russian authors for some reason. But one thing that's really interesting in these books that were written 100 years ago, the things that people did that caused them ease was sitting out and noticing the color of the cherry blossoms or how the leaves swayed, or how somebody walked. I mean, it was all so present, and I have ease just reading about, did you know there's lime trees in Russia? They're not our lime trees, but they're lime trees. And there's so many descriptions in Dostoevsky about the beautiful lime trees on either side of these roads that are, I mean, it's just absolutely gorgeous descriptions. And we don't take the time to actually experience that. So on this day when you experiment, do that. Notice if you're starting to get antsy, I gotta be doing something. That goes in the no good thought. Get rid of that. Let that one be. Come back to just being, enjoying, just living and breathing. We don't give ourselves time enough to do that. And then monitor your mind as you're doing this throughout the day. I kept a journal, and it was really helpful. And I think journaling is very helpful because you can see what was helpful and what wasn't. What you forgot, and we tend to forget a lot. Forget what we're doing. Remind yourself with your own journal, with your own description of what you need to do. Oh, this kind of was cute. Speaking of the internet, I've pretty much given up on Facebook. I found it caused too much agitation. The only time I go on, okay, Rich says he's going on vacation. Rich and Mary are going someplace. Okay, I'll go check. I want to see their pictures. Michael Patty is in Vietnam. I heard that through somebody. So, you know, he's another Sangha member, so I wanted to see what happened. And by the way, he was in a motor scooter accident. He's fine. So that's what that's about all I do on Facebook now is look at things like that because I found I was just getting agitated. Things that I could do nothing about that were in my face, you know, just caused me such great sadness, or things that I disliked about something that I could do nothing about. So I quit. And then I read this article, and it was entitled, "You Think You Enjoy the Internet, But..." And this guy said he finds it very interesting as we're on the internet, everybody seems to want to then take a break and look at an animal video. You know, a cute dog or cat video or a squirrel video or... I know I did that. You know, and he said he found it interesting that, you know, you can only take so much and then it's got to be the animal video. And so this was in the New York Times, and his favorite video was, and I looked at it about 10 times, and he said he's looked at it like 111 times. It's a window with a parrot on one side and a cat on the other, and the cat is looking at the parrot and its tail is going back and forth, and the parrot is looking at the cat, but the parrot goes down so the cat can't see it, and then it comes up and goes, peekaboo, and it goes down again, and then comes up, peekaboo, and the cat is just totally, you know, freaked out by this. Where is this bird going? Anyway, the guy said he found that as he was on the internet, he would go back to this video all the time. And so I'm going to read what he says. "And yet, in the moment-to-moment reality of online life, theory of mind fritzes out. I find it easier to identify with a parrot playing peekaboo or with a ferret stuck in a toilet paper tube than I do with the loudest voices on Twitter. The internet, the great connector, ends up atrophying our most basic connective skill, that imaginative leap into another mind, the attempt to understand what it knows and believes, why it moves the way it moves. Not that this has ever been easy. We're not going to snap our fingers and make one another more humane. But the commercial internet does seem aggressively engineered to prevent us from getting any closer to each other. We are online constantly looking for each other, and yet we are so rarely there to be seen. And so instead, we watch the animals. Peek-a-boo. So that to me was just a really good example of something we'll do, but if we start looking at it and we put it in the two categories of thinking, it's not helpful. It doesn't cause ease. It causes anxiety, which is why so many people skip over to the animal videos, to the cute things, to get some modicum of normalcy back again. So that's about it. Does anybody have any, not that I can answer any questions. As Mio at Valley Stream says, I'm not the question man, I'm not the question woman either, but happy to hear you. Yeah.
I was just wondering, when you do your month-long solo retreat, do you get in your car?
No. No. Boy, talk about agitation. Yeah. No, I found that there is really a reason why retreats are set up the way they are. I thought I could get away with, you know, doing more, but you can't. There's agitation in so many things, and you really want a break from that. So I do listen to podcasts instead of Dharma talks now, because I feel I've listened to every Dharma talk there is in the world. That's an exaggeration, obviously, but good podcasts, thoughtful podcasts, I really enjoy. And there's a lot of good ones.
The one you just mentioned earlier.
Invisibilia.
Invisibilia?
Yeah, yeah. It's a very good one. Yeah. I think Ian listens to that one too, yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm reflecting on what you're saying, and I'm thinking, well, the challenge for me is how to develop other thoughts. Because, you know, my thoughts arise out of the realm of volition. I don't will them there. I'm just thinking about where I'm sitting. At least in my life lately, most of these thoughts, if I really think about them, are not helpful.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. And I'm thinking, oh, gee, okay. We're talking about pausing and noticing that and acknowledging that. But then, good thoughts, can I just kind of wait? They rise by themselves because they're not living my life. You see, I don't know if you understand the question.
But yeah.
Practice.
That is the practice. And actually, this is one of the reasons we meditate, is to notice exactly what you're noticing. And the more you discard, it's not that you can't, we can't stop them from coming up. They're going to come up. But we don't have to stay with them. As the Buddha said, I notice them and I let them go. And with mindfulness, we can do that. Now, they're going to keep popping up again, but every time you let them go, after a while, they stop coming up. And then
will helpful thoughts arise?
Yes, they will. And one thing I forgot, because this is important, you just reminded me of it. If you do this, you know, and you take a day and just start experimenting with the unskillful thoughts and the skillful thoughts, here's another measurement of how it's doing. And this is also talked about in the Metta Sutta. Dreams become very vivid and wonderful. And this is when you know you're doing it right. At least for me, that's when I figured I'm doing it okay. Because dreams, it's your subconscious, you know, coming out. And, you know, in the Metta Sutta, it says, if you're practicing correctly, the dreams are wonderful and you sleep well. So it's kind of off topic, but what you're saying, but the practice is noticing this is unskillful, it's not helpful, let it go. It will go as soon as you say, I'm letting it go. It will come back. You do it again, and you might have to do it 25 times. Eventually, it's not going to come back. Yeah. No.
And then I think the other half of it for me has been, if you notice the ill will, the non-skillful, the unskillful side, it dissipates. And then as you notice the more skillful things, or cultivate the more skillful things,
they do grow.
Absolutely.
And it, what I'm noticing is this sort of emptying out thing, like stuff doesn't have the same charge.
Exactly.
So you have room to notice the flowers.
Exactly.
You know, it's not so complicated anymore.
Exactly. That's very well put.
But I know I constantly have to remember metta and karuna, and it's like, because the tendency of the mind, at least this mind, is to sink.
Yes.
So I find very subtle ways that I work with sadness or pain or what, those are very compelling for me.
Yeah.
Maybe my age, maybe where I am in my life right now. So working on the, inclining the mind towards those happier, more skillful things is really useful. And it really does work.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, recently there's a situation that I've discovered that was a very disappointing situation of someone that I thought I knew that sort of had my best interests at heart, but I've discovered that's not the case. And trust me, I've had all kinds of, like, I want to tell you about yourself kind of thoughts, and then the other thought will come up, like, that's probably not the best way to handle it. But I guess my question is, when or is it ever the right speech or to tell a person that they really disappointed you?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, and actually, well, I don't want to go into what the details are, it's more in a business area, but still, I'm trying to write it on my side and take care of it as much as I can, but I knew this person a long time, and I'm just kind of surprised. I thought I knew them better.
Mm-hmm.
So in that situation, what is the skillful way to handle the disappointment and letting them, would you let them know that or just move on?
Yeah. Well, you have to also calculate, why do you want to let them know? Is it got to do with I'm right and you're wrong, or is there a purpose for it? And then you look into, I'm assuming, right speech. Is it kind? Is it timely? Is it the truth? I mean, there's all kinds of criteria about speaking. So you look at the motivation first. And often, if we're honest with each other, the motivation is for me to be right. And if that is honestly the case, then you have to work with that.
What if the person is actually unethical? Am I still not getting the question? I might not be able to see it because I am really have been running it, and it's been, you know, so I realize I might not be able to take in what you're saying yet, but I will listen to it.
Yeah.
Take it in.
You know, the Buddha said we should have little to do with unethical people. They're not to be trusted. Doesn't mean we are cruel. It's just that these are not, when he gave standards of a friend, that was one of them, that we don't associate with people that we cannot trust, that are not true to their word. So that's about all I can say about it. And then you have to figure out how you can respond skillfully, you know, taking all of that into account.
I am trying to weigh that with all of the
I know.
Dark thoughts.
Well, that's one thing you need to work with first is, you know, that wish for harm or ill will. That's not going to be helpful in you figuring out how to tackle this situation. So that would be the first thing I think that you should work with.
I tried to say, do the meta thing today, and I said, no, I'm not there. It's not real for me yet. So I just let it go for now.
It takes a while. You know, when you're in a situation like that and all of a sudden, well, I'm going to say metta, now I'll feel good, you know.
I put myself in this.
Dennis taught us a really good practice of it, the forgiveness practice, mm-hmm. where you can say something like, you know, even if I cannot forgive you right now, may I start the process?
Mm-hmm.
Because forgiveness is not really, I mean, it's for you that you're forgiving.
That's right.
Letting go of that. The bad feelings inside of you, not necessarily, you're not condoning what they've done, but, you know, it's a really nice practice, and I think there's like a whole, it's almost like metta. You can go through a certain
right.
series of meditations on forgiveness that
right.
are really sweet.
Yeah.
For yourself, for others.
Right.
I think it's around somewhere.
Yeah, thank you.
Get a copy of it if you like.
Anybody else have anything?
I'm just responding to what you said, and patience is, I went through something quite difficult. I want to tell you, it took me over a year to get anywhere close to closure.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, be patient with yourself. You know, it's tricky. That stuff can be really tricky.
Yeah, I mean, we're human beings, you know, and it's difficult. And I know I used to get very annoyed with ill will. Well, just do metta. Really? Really? That's not helpful. But actually, it is. You just have to start someplace. Like Renee said, maybe it's starting with forgiveness, and a lot of teachers have you practice forgiveness first, and then start with metta. But you have to start someplace. Ill will is going to cause you harm more than anyone else. And we start with ourselves. We have to, because we're not going to be able to affect anyone else unless we start with ourselves. And not easy. I mean, life's not easy. It'd be great if just here's the formula, here's what you do, everything will be fine. You know, not quite like that. All right, 2 minutes to nine. We're going to be stopping right now. So let's do a final dedication of merit. May all of us have the ability to look at our thoughts and be able to classify them and allow thoughts that cause us and others harm, allow them to leave, to constantly let them be, and allow the thoughts and emotions and activities that cause goodness in ourselves and will be helpful to others to arise. May we practice this until it becomes a way of life, and contentment and ease are part of our nature. And may we pass that contentment and ease onto all living beings with whom we come in contact. And may all of us in this room and may all beings eventually be completely free. Thank you all.